to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeBias. For this week's film show, we're joined by David Jenkins, editor of Little White Lies magazine. Now today, in place of our usual review of three cinematic releases, we're going to be shining our spotlight on a festival dedicated to the rediscovery of rare and little-known films, Bologna's Il Cinema Ritrovato. David was there and he'll be telling us all about it. That's all to come here on the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeBias. Welcome to the show, David. Now, today we're going to be talking about Il Cinema Ritrovato, the festival in Bologna. Now, the festival just celebrated its 30th year and it's dedicated to very rare films and it has a sense of discovery. Sounds interesting. Tell us a little bit more. Why is it different from any other festival on the circuit?
Well, I guess apart from the fact that a lot of festivals now are kind of quite PR driven and there's celebrities and red carpets. And I think there's a lot of kind of celebrity razzmatazz that kind of goes with the films. And I think a lot of festivals now are about promoting new films. Mm-hmm. And this is basically about preserving the gems from the past, rediscovering them, unearthing them, playing them in a new, exciting context, bringing them to new audiences, hopefully.
I find that fascinating because it's a bit like a buried treasure in a way, films that have been long, long, long forgotten. You open the top of the chest and you find diamonds.
Absolutely. I mean, it is almost like cinema as archaeology. It's kind of, digging for treasure. And the festival employs lots of these very knowledgeable cinephiles and curators, programmers to find these films and put them together in a kind of series that are a bit more interesting than just like, oh, here's a director, here's a genre.
It's a theme.
It's kind of building these interesting themes that, mean that you get these individual fascinating films that have been sort of dredged up from history. They're being presented in a really interesting context where you can compare and contrast films with each other from the era, from actors and themes, producers, styles from studios, and it's just a fascinating game to play.
And I can imagine the whole of Bologna is taken over by film buffs. What's the atmosphere like?
Oh, it's hard to kind of temper yourself when talking about this festival because, like, from someone like myself who, I watch a fair amount of movies, to be able to go to a city like Bologna, which kind of coincidentally has some of the best food in the world, and then get to dedicate a week to just really just watching film after film after film with kind of like-minded people is just heaven. And one of the great things about the festival too is it's really not this kind of haven for hardcore film buffs. There's a real sense that they're trying to open it up to the city as well. And the programmers have every night in the Piazza Maggiore, in front of a big basilica church, open air screenings of classics. One of the ones I attended this year was of Vincenzo Minnelli's The Bandwagon, which is a Fred Astaire film, screened from Martin Scorsese's own personal print. And it was absolutely fit to burst, people wide-eyed until the wee hours.
Well, lucky listeners, I think we have a clip of the film. Let's talk about some of your other highlights. Let's start with a special program of films by producer Carl Lamley Jr. Tell us a bit more about the man and why his work deserves this kind of festival spotlight.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I must say, prior to going to this festival, the name Carl Lamley Jr. was someone, it was just a name that I'd spotted on film credits and never really taken that much interest in, which I'm sure most people do when they're watching old movies, seeing old names crop up again and again. And a programmer from New York, Dave Kerr, created this massive program of films which brought together all his work and has framed him as this kind of radical unheralded producer from the 30s.
But I gather his father was the founder of Universal Pictures.
Yes, yes, that's right. And he, I guess, took on the baton and yeah, it was behind this very diverse array of Universal films throughout the 30s. And
garnering a reputation, I gather, for going wildly over budget.
On occasion. I mean, there were films where he did go wildly over budget. And there was a film called The King of Jazz at the festival, which I think it was when it was presented, Dave Kerr said in his intro that it was this kind of folly at the time. And it was one of the most expensive films they ever made. And it was one of the very early color films as well. It's a kind of really bizarre sketch movie centered around the jazz musician.
It's almost like a jazz review, a sequence of jazz music and dance numbers.
It is. It's a very, very strange film. It's kind of, I'm not sure it's past the test of time. It's very un-PC. I wouldn't say that necessarily is a bad thing in terms of its interest as an artifact. I mean, it presents a very kind of whitewashed version of jazz music, and some of the sketches are a little kind of cringy.
This was early 1930s.
Yeah, this is very early 1930s, like the year 1930, in fact. So,
well, shall we have a listen to a clip from the film The King of Jazz?
When you find that your mind keeps you worried and blue, you can always let your feet keep your disposition sweet. I wanna see what makes me feel the way I do. Will you kindly cast an eye on two good reasons why? Happy feet, I've got those happy feet. Give them a low-down beat, and they begin dancing.
Musical sampler from The King of Jazz. Now, another film, which is quite intriguing, in this program is Only Yesterday. Tell us a little bit about this film.
Yeah, this was fantastic. This is a melodrama by the director John M. Stahl, who is kind of perhaps little known compared to someone like Douglas Sirk, of whom he makes kind of similar films. But yeah, it's sort of set at the end of the Wall Street crash, and it's a retelling of Stefan Zweig's Letter from an Unknown Woman, mm-hmm. set in America, with Margaret Sullavan as the kind of unknown woman getting together with a GI before he jets off to the Second World War, and they have a fling and he forgets her and she kind of pines for him from across town, and it's this like desperately sad melodrama. And I think one of the things about this festival, I mean, I guess a general point about the festival is you watch these films and you don't necessarily think after everyone, wow, that was a lost masterpiece. Why isn't this more well known? With this one, you definitely did. I mean, it really had this kind of strength and power, and in these incredible performances, and the way it was shot so beautifully and choreographed.
Incredible opening sequence with this just over the top cocktail party before the crash.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of terrifying, and nobody knows what's happening. And I mean, it's really dark in that, you know, there are people committing suicide. Mm. The opening shot is of a man walking from a trading floor and shooting himself. And I mean, that's quite a, you know, I don't call it prescient opening.
Well, no, it's funny because I was reading about it just before we came into the studio, and I started looking at, there are a number of clips, you can go back, there are a number of clips for the movie. And it struck me, it was such a sort of heady, fascinating story. And I thought, you know, if I was a sort of young, feisty producer, I would go to this festival looking for films just like this that you think, there's such great story potential here to make a reversion, a contemporary version, taking sort of some of the themes and ideas and just making it of the moment.
Absolutely. In this program in particular, there was so many films that you were watching thinking, you know, the if you just would take out the kind of romantic dynamic at the center of the story and recontextualize it into a different time and place, you could get so much mileage out of these films. I mean, I think that's another thing that, I mean, a lot of industry people do go to the festival. I'm not entirely sure whether they do go for those purposes, but maybe they should, really.
They will be after listening to the show. Well, let's move on now to another strand. Fascinating. It's called the early Japanese color film strand, looking at films from the 1950s. Now, again, not your normal sort of fare for a film festival circuit.
No, not really, but fascinating nonetheless. Sorry, I think I keep saying the word fascinating, but it seems so apt for this festival. A strand programmed. The first part was actually programmed last year, and this is a kind of return with some more movies and recent restorations. One of them was premiered at Venice. Japan were kind of famous for coming to color film very late, where America came to color in the 30s, and yeah, Japan weren't really doing any color until very early 50s. So it's kind of interesting to see these films, very, very kind of bright, saturated color, and just they seem very individual, I guess.
And is there something about the way, because it was still quite experimental, so they had to do two versions of the film?
Yeah, there was often, I think, sometimes the actual color process, it was in its early experimental phase. And so I'm guessing for insurance purposes, they would shoot it on black and white at the same time. And if they had the color version, they would be able to release the color one. And if it went okay and it wasn't too expensive, but then if it would prove a lost leader, then they had the black and white one. I mean, there's a film called Carmen Comes Home, which is one of the films that in The Strand, which was a very funny. I mean, one of the interesting things also about this is that often Japanese cinema that makes it to the West is the kind of, you know, you get the big masterpieces, basically the ones that the kind of
Kurosawa,
cultural gates, yeah, Ozu, Misoguchi, all those guys that, you know, who have been let through into the West. And sometimes it means you don't really, if there's a kind of popular hit, that's the stuff you don't really get to see. And one of the things they were showing at the festival was the kind of, these were the popular hits in Japan at the time, which sometimes, you know, the humor and the subjects don't necessarily translate, but they're really interesting to sort of get an image of a time and a place. Carmen Comes Home is this kind of, again, I think perhaps ripe for a remake, but it's about a country family whose daughter left them to become a stripper in Tokyo.
In the 50s,
yes. It's very kind. It's not sort of sexy. It's cheeky, I would say. But they return to the countryside. It's very similar to the film Tamara Drew, if you've seen that. Mm-hmm. And they come back, and one of the kind of funny things about it is that the way it's made is that they're really trying to emphasize the color. So the dresses that the girls wear are these really eye-popping colours, like,
fabulous,
you know, bright yellows, reds, polka dots, and then in every shot you have this big mountain in the background, and they seem like every single angle that they shoot from always seems to have this big, huge kind of smoking mountain in the background, and it's almost funny by the end that they're sort of so desperate to get the colour of this kind of, you know, the verdant green hillsides, and yeah, it's a very amusing film.
Cinematic heaven. Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Thanks very much to my guest, David Jenkins. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeVries. The show was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time on Monday when we'll be talking art. But for now, goodbye from me, and thanks for listening.